The January 29th, 2007 meeting of the Public Safety Budget Division is called to order. Our item of business today is the Department of Corrections presenting their budget proposals. Commissioner? Welcome back.
Thank you. It's nice to be back.
Members, you all have your new budget books. They are yours for the duration. Feel free to scribble all over them, and we'll figure out this budget all together.
Madam Chair.
Senator Foley.
Are we going to take these back with us, or are you going to leave them here? Because usually we don't carry them back.
What would you like to do? We certainly can take care of them as a division if you would like and keep them.
Yeah.
Okay. Commissioner?
Madam Chair and members, it's really a very difficult and sad day for our department. You may have heard on the news that about the death of one of our staff at Stillwater Prison early yesterday morning. And there's an ongoing investigation right now by the BCA and the Bayport Police into this death. And until that investigation's complete, we really can't comment on the circumstances, but it has been revealed that no inmate was involved in this offender's death, and the Bayport police chief has ruled out foul play. So I would think the coroner is going to make a determination fairly quickly, and we'll get you the information when it's public.
Thank you.
Our agency priorities in this budget contribute to public safety by increasing incarcerating the state's most dangerous offenders and providing opportunities for rehabilitation and change, and also to effectively supervise offenders in the community on probation and supervised release. And the funding recommendations in this budget are essential to core services related to public safety, and they'll allow us to safely and efficiently run our 10 facilities, accommodate needs related to population increases, responsibly fund employee compensation adjustments, and direct much-needed resources to Minnesota's three delivery systems, currently supervising thousands of offenders in our communities on probation and supervised release. It also gives some relief to the counties with the short-term offender issue and increases our reentry efforts. So if we start with the first slide, I just want to start with saying that the Department of Corrections budget is unique in a number of areas. All of our operations directly impact public safety. And because it's a 24/7 operation in much of our department, it's really impossible to absorb the increased cost to maintain the current operations. Also, the prison population, as you've heard over and over again, has been increasing, and it was 83% in the last 10 years, and the probation population has increased 32% during that time. And fortunately, the annual growth is slowing, but it is still growing, so we need to look at that issue very carefully. And we, unlike other programs, have no ability to have waiting lists or to control the volume that come to us. We have to take anyone that the court commits. And in addition, unlike some other agencies, we really don't have alternative funding sources to support our operations. The budget includes $941 million. It's a 10.5% increase from the last fiscal years, 06 and 07. And if you notice that the facilities, it's 70% of the funding goes for the facilities, 26% for community services, and 4% for operation support. Deputy Commissioner Benson is going to talk about some of the facility issues.
Commissioner Benson.
Madam Chair and members, my name is Dennis Benson. I'm the Deputy Commissioner responsible for institution services. And I'm going to spend a few moments now on some of our change item that were included in the governor's budget request. And at the bottom of these slides, or on the bottom of your handout, you can see the corresponding budget page if you want to follow along in your budget book. The first one that we'll talk about is what we refer to as a tails fix, or annualizing session cuts last year. Last year we went in for a base adjustment for inflation. We were underfunded by about $1.975 million each year, or the second year of the or just last year, and that had to be fixed this year. It's something that we had discussed with finance during the end of the session last year, and we included this in our request to the governor, and it's really a hole in our base budget. It's $3.95 million for the biennium. It's a 1.975 per year. The next change item request is offender health services. This is not an uncommon request. I think we've talked about it probably for the last five consecutive years. Healthcare for our inmate population continues to rise. And it's the governor is recommending $1 million for 08 and $1.5 million for 09 for a total of 2.5. A variety of things continue to drive health care costs. Most of all, it's health care inflation. But also, and we've talked about this too, we have a population that has health issues that are somewhat unique to an incarcerated population, in that they're not the most healthy population because they simply haven't taken the best care of themselves. Some of the drivers are hepatitis C. About 18 to 20% of our population is infected with hepatitis C, which is it's quite a price tag to treat hepatitis. HIV, compared to other states, we're relatively low. We only have about 50 that we know about that are infected. Diabetes and dialysis are other drivers of health care costs every year. And then methamphetamine, the drug, we've talked about this from time to time, the skyrocketing dental costs and psychological costs and, of course, treatment costs that come with managing that particular addiction. So again, the bottom line is $2.5 million for the biennium. I think there was a question how many deaths we had this past year, or what do we have, generally speaking. And this past year we had nine, and they range primarily from cancers to a heart attack, aneurysm, kidney failure, and I think we had two end-stage liver disease as a result of hepatitis C.
Senator Brugger.
Madam Chair and Assistant Commissioner Benson, could you tell me the 11% increase over the last 4 years, how much of that has been due to pharmaceutical and how much of that has been due to other health inflation?
Commissioner Benson.
Madam Chair and Senator Berglund, I defer to our health care director, Nan Larson, who is available to respond to that question. I can give you some general statistical information around prescription drugs. Of that budget, $4.3 million is for prescription drugs, and 35% is psychotropic meds. And as we've said, about 25% of our male population is on psychotropic meds, a little over 50% of our female population, and right around 50% of our juvenile. But what the precise piece of that 11% inflator is pharmaceuticals, I'm not sure we have that information today. If we don't, we can certainly get it for you.
Ms. Larson, welcome to our committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Nan Larson. I'm the Director of Health Services. Senator Berglund, 11% is the inflationary rate of our pharmaceuticals. We look at it compared to industry growth, and it's somewhere between 11 and 14%. So,
and then, Senator Madam Berglund? Chair and Ms. Larson, how much then is inflation on your health care contracts?
Ms. Larson.
Madam Chair, 11% for both.
Madam Chair and Senator Berglund, the way we broke out our contract is based on inpatient costs, outpatient costs, pharmaceutical costs, medical supplies. And so we have increases for all of those. I think there's also some administrative costs as well built into that contract. So I can get you the overall inflationary increases for the contract.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Senator Berglund.
And when I get it, could I get it for each of the 4 years instead of collectively? So I could see if it's more this year than it was the first of the 4 years.
Madam Chair and Senator Berglund, I can give it to you since the beginning of this 5-year contract that we have with them.
Sure. Okay. Thank you.
Madam Chair.
Senator Neville.
Ms. Larson, can you provide that to the whole committee? I'd like to see that, too. I'm not sure.
Yes, Madam Chair, yes.
If you get it to us, we'll get it to all the committee members.
Okay.
All right, Commissioner Benson.
Madam Chair and members, we're going to move on now to fuel and utilities. This is another change item request that the governor included in the budget. For fiscal year 08, it's $1.5 million. And fiscal year 09, $1.5 million for $3 million for the biennium. Our agency has been absorbing fuel and utility costs for many, many years. We are doing a variety of things to try to get out in front of some of these increases, to and including installing new heat plants, boilers. We just installed 3 boilers at the Stillwater facility. We are upgrading the boilers down at Faribault as we expand that facility. We have conducted energy audits. We're in the process of including green audits, which go a little bit beyond just heat sources, windows, lights, ballasts, those kinds of things. So we're trying to get ahead of this and absorb at least a piece of the fuel and utility increases. We can tell you that from 05 to 06, our fuel and utilities costs went up about 32%. So this is an area that we've really historically had quite a bit of difficulty keeping up with, and one that we just feel that we absolutely have to have some help to make sure that the 5.5 million square feet of heated space continues to be heated, so that our staff and certainly the offenders as well are in an area that is sort of comfortable. We have many, many old places. I know some of you were in Stillwater last Friday, and it was warm. I would suggest that the other thing that we're looking at is the lag time of either heating a facility up when it gets cold real quickly or cooling it down when it starts to warm up is difficult in those traditional old plants, and hopefully with some of the new technology we can preserve some energy costs there as well. The last point on the slide speaks to a relationship we had at Stillwater with the L&S King heating plant for about 15 years. We were buying heat very, very cheaply, pumping it up to the facility, but when they upgraded that plant, there was no longer excess steam available, so we were on our own, and we've been scrambling the last couple of years to install boilers, and we just fired them up about a month ago. The next change item request is retiree insurance. We have correctional officers that, as part of their negotiated benefit, to get paid health care upon retirement. And again, with the number of people that are retiring, we're responsible for those premiums until they reach age 65. And this is another area where there is not an automatic adjuster in our budget, something that we have had to absorb. And again, we're at that point where we simply can't continue to absorb these costs because it's getting to be very significant. The number in included in the governor's budget is $1 million for the biennium, $500,000 for 08 and 09.
Senator Neville.
Mr. Benson, is that retiree insurance benefit something unique to corrections, or are all state employees entitled to that?
Madam Chair, Senator Neville, yes, in our agency it is unique to correctional officers and those staff members that have documented 75% contact daily with offenders. It would also include our Office of Special Investigations. They're under the police pension, so they are included. It's a little bit different fund, but the Correctional Officers Early Retirement Program is primarily the 1,800 correctional officers, caseworkers, psychologists, nurses. There are some industry foremen that are included. Wardens, associate wardens, unit directors are not included. And, of course, all of us in our central office are not included as well.
Just to follow up, this is what's comparable to what law enforcement or police officers get, where they can retire at 55?
Madam Chair, Senator Neville, yes, that's correct. Actually, they can go at age 50, but there is a reduced annuity if they go at 50, and there's also an adjustment for the amount of insurance that we're responsible for.
So,
Senator Neville.
So, Madam Chair, why are you asking for more this year, but you've been apparently absorbing that in the past? What's unique this time?
Madam Chair and Senator Neville, we've sort of reached the precipice of what we can absorb. The other thing that I would suggest is in the last 2, 3, 4 years, the front end of the boomers are starting to retire, and it's just something that we can't suck up anymore. It's becoming a pretty big pile of money. I think this year we're actually in that budget predicting that we're going to be underfunded by over $500,000.
All right, thank you.
Commissioner Engelbretson.
Madam Chair.
Commissioner, does the state of Minnesota, this particular group, look at or participate in the health care savings plan?
Commissioner Benson.
Madam Chair and Senator Engelbretson, they have the same insurance options that all state employees have. The only difference is who pays the premium on retirement. During their working years, they're entitled to pick during open enrollment, like all of us. And I believe they can also bank time when they retire, too, into the savings plan for when they reach 65, when they have to start to pay for their supplemental policy.
Thank you.
Other questions?
I'm Chair, Committee members. My name is Harley Nelson. I'm Deputy Commissioner of Community Services. Community program costs. The Challenge Incarceration Program, which if you saw, got a very favorable evaluation. It was a very successful program. Is expanding from 90 beds to 180 beds. That 90-bed expansion is happening this month and in the next couple of months. Part of the reason the program is successful is that there's intensive supervision by corrections agents as they go into phase 2, 3, and 4 of the program. And so that transition into the community, we need an additional 6 agents starting in July, when the majority of those new offenders coming out of the new 90 beds will start to come out onto the field, into the community. And then we're looking for, in the next year, another 4 agents. So it's $600,000 in fiscal year 08 and $1 million in fiscal 09. $100,000 per agent, because we're usually looking at the most experienced agents that are at the top of their scale and are the best ones to do this job, and there's a lot of transportation costs around the state. Conditional release program is operating and doing quite well. This is the program where drug offenders come into the prison. Lower-level drug offenders can be released early if they go through chemical dependency treatment. Here again, also a major part of this program is the intensive supervised part in the community when they come out. We're looking, there is temporary funds right now for this program of $600,000. There's only 35 offenders out right now, so we've only filled three of those spots, but we expect these numbers to grow. We expect it to level off somewhere in the 90 number, and that's why we're looking for permanent funding of $600,000 a year for those six agents on a permanent basis. Interstate compact costs, we have a new interstate compact that's been in effect here now about 4 years, I believe. There's $35,000 a year fees. There's some additional things that are happening with the national database that we're going to have some expenditures there to hook up as we move those offenders from state to state. And there's some additional position, there's a couple of different positions that we may need for tracking these offenders and doing the work under the new interstate compact. Predatory risk risk assessment, both in the community notification and the risk assessment portion of it, there's more work than we expected. We sent 165 referrals last year. We expect it to be higher this year. We also have the legal expertise of the judiciary that we need to fund as far as reviewing those cases, along with the teams. So that's a cost that we are incurring, and we need $350,000 a year in that program.
Senator Berglund.
Madam Chair, could we get a breakdown of the interstate compact costs? I mean, you kind of went through that pretty fast. If you could get that, I think, to the members of the committee in writing.
Okay, we'll do that. Madam Chair, Senator Berglund, we'll get that to you.
Senator Rosen.
Madam Chair, there's no question that's too stupid, is there?
Not in this committee.
Could somebody explain what the interstate compact?
Sure. Commissioner Nelson, could you explain what the interstate compact is?
Maybe I'll defer to Ken Mers, who is in his area, and he is the expert of it, and he does represent the commissioner on that compact, so he will do a better job than I would.
Okay. Welcome, Mr. Mers.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. My name is Ken Mers, and I am the Director of Administrative Services for the department under which the interstate compact is a part. The interstate compact is a mechanism that is used. It's all 50 states are members, as well as the District of Columbia, Puerto Rico, and the Virgin Islands are all members of the interstate compact. When an offender is convicted in one state and then it wants to move his supervision to another state, he could have, for example, lives in Minnesota, was over in Wisconsin, got into trouble over there, got arrested for a DWI or whatever, was placed on probation in Wisconsin, but they live in Minnesota, they work in Minnesota, they belong in Minnesota, they need to transfer that supervision to the state of Minnesota. And then this is the mechanism that the states use to move offenders between the borders.
Senator Rosa?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Mers, and there's a fiscal attachment to it as far as...
Yes, about 4 years ago, this state, again, entered into a new compact. And the new compact, which all 50 states, again, joined, one of the problems with the old compact was there was never any enforcement. There was never any teeth to it. So that if an offender moved from state to state and violated the compact, there was no way of enforcing the rules. Under the new compact now, there is an enforcement aspect to it. There are some costs that, in order to do this, there are administrative costs where all states now, it used to be a $2,000 a year annual fee to be part of the compact. Now it's $35,000 a year to be a part of the compact. There is going to be a new tracking system. Another problem with the old compact was there was no uniform way of keeping track of offenders that moved between the states. We are now implementing a new tracking system, a new data entry system that will track all offenders and their movements across the state. So we will need to update all of our data systems and hook up to this national system. There's going to be startup costs with that, as well as an ongoing maintenance and training, which will be required in order to have all jurisdictions be able to enter their information into the system.
So this is a nationwide database?
Right. That's right, Madam Chair. In addition, then, with the compliance issues now under the new compact, we feel that we do need a position that will be able to work with all of the local jurisdictions in the state of Minnesota to train them and to work with them on all of the compliance issues. and to, when there are violations, to work with those local jurisdictions on how to correct those in the same time.
So, Mr. Mers, how many people are we talking about in Minnesota being part of this database?
I don't have the exact numbers, but it's I believe last year there was approximately 10,000 offenders, I believe, that were from Minnesota that were being supervised in some other jurisdiction, and approximately the same number from other jurisdictions who are now being supervised in the state of Minnesota. Now, the one thing to understand is the Interstate Compact, it's not a reciprocal agreement. It's not, we'll send you one, you send us one. It all depends upon what the circumstances are in the individual cases as to whether that offender gets transferred. So we may have more offenders that come into Minnesota than actually go out to other states.
And how much say-so do we get in that?
Pardon me?
How much say-so does the state get in who comes and goes?
There are mandatory criteria that if the offender meets the mandatory criteria, we have no say. We have to accept that case. If the person does not meet the mandatory requirements, but the other state is making some type of a case for some reason why that offender should come here, we can look at it, and we can, it's what we would call a discretionary case, and we do have some say in those cases. But the ones that meet the mandatory criteria, we don't have. We have to accept those cases.
Okay. Senator Berger.
So how much of this request for the Interstate Compact is for the data entry, and is that a one-time cost?
I can get you those exact numbers, Senator. There will be some one-time cost, but there will also be an ongoing cost to maintain the system and to, keep it up to date.
In your budget that you proposed, did you put it all in ongoing rather than one time?
Yes.
Okay. We'd like that more accurate information if we could, please. Other questions? Okay, continue on, please.
The next slide you've seen before, I just wanted to reemphasize the unique partnership that Minnesota has in the way we handle offenders in Minnesota. And the vast majority are better served at the local level and leaving the state prisons for the most dangerous offenders. So this is just a breakdown of the number of people on probation in Minnesota. Whether they're male or female. And I want to emphasize how that we have approximately 135,000 if you include the 4,000 supervised release offenders released from prison. That leads into the next slide where we talk about the three delivery system. Again, sometimes it's a little, until you've seen it a few times, it's not exactly easy to understand. And we are asking for money for all three delivery systems because, again, in Minnesota, it works well. In the Department of Corrections, we supervise all the felons in 55 counties that the community corrections counties don't supervise. We also contract to do 27 counties for their juvenile and misdemeanor supervision. The Community Corrections Act counties, which have about 75% of the offenders, provide all those services in the individual counties. And the county probation officers supervise juvenile and misdemeanors in 28 counties. So with that, the other issue I wanted to bring up was that there have been certainly some delivery system issues over the last few years. When you look at the 135,000 people in the communities, the systems have all taken an 8% reduction overall since 2003 and also had a very significant increase in their offender numbers on supervision.
What we are looking at is new funding, and the funding that they have gotten in the communities really has specifically been given to them specifically for sex offenders. And we have gotten some good increases in money, but that leaves the other caseloads, the non-sex offender caseloads, very high. And a number of those offenders are also high risk. We're also recommending that the new funding be contingent upon implementation of evidence-based best practices in each of the three delivery systems, and all systems agree with that.
Okay. Senator Foley, and then Senator Berger.
Madam Chair, Commissioner, when you look at that, tell me what the costs are of an individual that's in these various supervised roles, and then ultimately, I want to lead into where you'll tell me what it costs to incarcerate somebody. In other words, I'm looking at the cost of the incarceration versus the
cost of probation supervision.
Of probation. Do you have that?
Mr. Nelson.
Madam Chair, Senator Foley, at the high end of the range, you're looking at about $21-$22 a day for supervision, and that's when they're on intensive supervised release. There may be some electronic monitoring going along with that. They're usually on caseloads of 1 to 15. That's the high part of the range, and if you had to have housing or halfway housing too, those costs would be added on to that. The low part of the range probably goes down to about, with the standard supervision, you're down to about maybe $8 to $10 a day at the most, and when you're down onto group supervision, it brings it down to about $2 or $3 or $4 a day. But group supervision, you're seeing them not very often. You're seeing them in large groups at a time. So there's quite a range depending upon it. That's why best practices says we do assessments. We assess the case as far as risk and needs and so forth and decide what level of supervision that we're going to put them on. Most of the counties are going to this best practice. They're starting to do. There's an LSIR, which does that kind of assessment that helps them decide how intensive that supervision should be. As they work through their way through the system and if they're behaving and not reoffending or committing technical violations, they will move on down through the system from the intensive supervision down to the lower levels of supervision. But the range, of just a quick answer to your question, supervision usually goes from about approximately a low of $3 to $4 a day up to about $21, $22 a day.
Senator Berglund?
Madam Chair, and whichever one of you wants to answer the question, what percentage increase would this be for offenders, supervision, and management? And then what percentage increase are your prison and central office staff given in the budget?
Madam Chair, Senator Berglund.
Commissioner Nelson.
There's a couple of different areas that we're going to. The first one, which the commissioner has not covered yet, but we're looking at funding there to the CCA subsidy of approximately 7.7% to the subsidy. Then there's some additional costs that are categorical later on as far as regarding to sex offenders that we're looking at. But the subsidy that was reduced by 8% will be going back and getting close to that 8% back with this budget in one part, but there'll be additional funding in other areas.
And Madam Chair, the second part of my question is what percentage or what COLA is being given to the central office and the staff that work in the facilities?
Madam Chair and Senator Berglund, we're going to get to a change item page on inflation. You're talking about cost of living. Central office, it's the 2%, and for our 24/7 operations and community services, which provides direct service to offenders in the community, I believe it's 4.25.
I noticed on the
each year,
Commissioner, each year?
Madam Chair, that's correct.
I noticed on the pages in the budget book that you don't give the current biennium amounts. And I think that would be useful for us on the top of page 20.
Well, Madam Chair, you're asking for what the current amount of money is in the biennium for that item?
Yes, please.
Like community correction subsidy is $36 million right now. You'd want to know that $36 million is being increased by a certain amount. Is that the data you want?
Yes, please. Senator Berglund?
Madam Chair, I don't know whether you guys know this or not. You may not, but was there some kind of rule in the budgeting process about the COLAs that would be given to state facilities that provide services on a 24/7 basis?
Commissioner Benson?
Madam Chair and Senator Berglund, that's correct. There's a different inflator for 24/7 operations in the governor's budget than there are for, like our central office, those that do not provide a direct 24/7 service. And again, for our correctional facilities, the COLA, the inflation is 4.25%. That's what is included in the governor's budget. For our central office, it's 2%.
And Madam Chair, the reason I'm asking the question is because for some of the other facilities, like the veterans homes and the regional treatment centers, it was 3.25 that was given in the governor's budget. So I'm just trying to understand why your 24/7 operations got 4.25% more each year.
Madam Chair, I'm going to defer to Jim King to respond to that question, our executive budget officer.
Welcome.
Finance.
Could you talk into the microphone?
Sure.
More,
Jim King from the Department of Finance.
Better.
Madam Chair, Senator Berglund, yes, there was a difference in the number used. I believe in the case of the Corrections Department, we were also considering the additional cost for the correctional officer pension plan, the state contributions, and that was an additional factor in the calculation for the Department of Corrections.
So, Madam Chair and Mr. King, does that amount to the extra 1%?
Yes, it does.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Other questions? Okay, proceed, please.
On the page 12, the recommendation is to provide 2.8 million a year, 5.6 for the Community Corrections Act subsidy. The 600,000 a year, 1.2 for the biennium for the Department of Corrections for supervised release and probation funding, and another 600,000 a year for the CPO reimbursement, or 1.2 million for the biennium. Part of this also is a key piece of making a reentry a success, because reduction on the caseloads will allow agents to provide more meaningful, responsible supervision as well. The next slide on page 13 is really looking at kind of finishing the investment in ensuring that sex offenders are supervised in the best way that they can be. After the legislative auditor's report, the 2005 legislature mandated that I convene a task force to recommend standards for supervision, for assessment, polygraphs, and treatment in the community. That report will be due to you. It is due to you on February, about the 7th. In that report, we have the standards that the professionals that have been involved in this work group are proposing require 40 new enhanced sex offender agents statewide. That would be 20 in 08 at $2 million and the 20 more in 09 for $4 million. That would allow all sex offenders to be supervised on enhanced caseloads of approximately 1 to 35. It also, in that, the mandate from the legislature was to look at
treatment and evaluating it to ensure what kind of treatment works and if it works. So the research and evaluation of sex offender treatment programs. Polygraph is a huge part of what the report is going to report on. And we have requested $500,000 in the budget for complying with all the research and evaluation recommendations by the legislative auditor. Also, community outpatient treatment grants, it would provide another $500,000 to the community for sex offender treatment and another million in 2009.
Senator Berglund.
Madam Chair and Commissioner, the research and evaluation of sex offender treatment programs and the polygraph use, how does that break down among the half million and 1 million that you're requesting? How much is for the polygraph use?
Madam Chair, I'm Senator Berglund. I'm going to let Harley, who's been very active in this.
Commissioner Nelson.
Madam Chair, Senator Berglund, the report's not out until February 15th, so these numbers are still somewhat rough in this area. But we know that if we're going to start to have standards for supervision and that we start to need to start to evaluate the programs and determine which ones are successful and so forth, that we're going to need some money in these areas. So we can give you a better breakdown, and certainly as the report comes out in February 15th, these things will start to fall into place.
Senator Berglund?
Well, Madam Chair, how did you get the number that you've got on the page to start with then?
Commissioner Nelson.
Madam Chair, Senator Berglund, these are some rough estimates. There is some preliminary drafts of the reports that we have an idea of what's happening, but we some of these things will need to be refined to some degree.
Madam Chair and Commissioner Nelson, is the research and evaluation component one-time money?
Madam Chair, Senator Berglund, we're going to need to continue to do evaluation research. It's not one-time money. I think best practices will tell you that you need to keep looking at your programs, finding out what works and what doesn't work. I think it's going to be an ongoing process for quite some time.
Well, Madam Chair, if I might just add my own editorial comment here, it seems to me like you need to be evaluating all of your programs all the time. And I'm sure you probably do that.
Madam Chair, Senator Berglund, I don't necessarily disagree with that. It's very difficult to find the resources that you do that. I think sex offenders are an area that's so important for the public safety. We certainly want to do it in this area. And that's why we are putting these kind of dollars in there to make sure that we do it with these offenders.
Other questions? Continue, please.
Madam Chair, the next page we have the sex offender assistance statistics just to show you what is happening in the BCA Predatory Offender Registry. I think there's 14,000 active registrants now. I think there's a number of others that have been through there and have gone off the registry for death and other reasons. About one-fourth of them are under supervision, though, and we're looking at those 6,945 offenders on supervision. And when we're saying supervision here, we're also mentioning the ones that are in prison. There's about 1,600 in prison as of 7/106. About 1,000 on supervised release. That's about a fourth of our supervised release caseload because we have about 4,000 on supervised release at any one time. We expect those numbers to rise with the longer-term conditional release of 5 years and 10 years, and there can be some offenders now coming out indefinite time that they will be on conditional release. There's another 3,400 adults on probation, about 607 juvenile sex offenders on probation, and about 300 now are in state hospitals as commits, and that number is growing. The next slide is sentenced to service work crews. We have a fund that has revenues in it that we were able to spend, and that fund had increased to the point that we needed to spend it down, and we went and did some sentence to service work crews. There's a project with Hennepin County for about $96,500. There's some other crews in Jackson, Cottonwood, Olmsted, Fillmore, Crow Wing, and Fairmont. And as that money spent down, and it was money that we needed to maintain and keep these sentenced to service work crews going, they're very popular with the public. We didn't want to discontinue them. And so we need some permanent funding to maintain these and make sure that we don't contract, that we're able to maintain what we have in sentenced to service work crews. And so this money of $600,000 will keep that going.
Commissioner, Senator Rosen has a question.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Commissioner King, how strong is the program out in Greater Minnesota? Can you tell me about the program in Greater Minnesota?
Madam Chair, Senator Rosen, it's the Sentence to Service program is very strong in outer Minnesota, Greater Minnesota. They've also been very effective. If you remember the floods and so forth, they are there to respond to emergencies. They've really been well received. I had some areas about where we're covered, but we're widely covered. They're not in all 87 counties, but we have sentenced to service crews going in a vast majority of the counties in rural Minnesota. And as I mentioned right here, these are Jackson, Cottonwood, Olmsted, Fillmore, Crow Wing, and Fairmont. These are some of the more outer greater Minnesota counties that we need to maintain these work crews. Picking up litter there for emergencies, windstorms. It's probably one of our best public relations that there is. And some of these offenders sometimes at times have been out there working with the other citizens when they're sandbagging for a flood. And it's been a very positive experience for them that they're helping save the community. It's been a very positive experience for the other citizens that work with them. And it's just a very excellent program.
What kind of offenders are eligible to work in the Sentence to Serve program?
Madam Chair, they're usually lower-level offenders. They're some of them are coming out of the jails. We have cooperative programs with the counties, so they may be coming out of the jail. They may be offenders that the judge sentenced to work crews as far as their sentence, which alleviates them from some expensive jail beds. They are usually the lower-level offender. You're not going to see a high-level person offender. You're not going to see a high-level sex offender out in the sentence to service crews.
The other question I had, I read in the budget book that the funds that pay for sentence to serve in previous years were carry forward funds from income contracts in dedicated receipt funds. I have no idea what that means.
We had a 200 fund, which when we contract with the counties end up paying us half the cost of the crew at times. We may provide the crew. The counties then will reimburse us for half the crew. It goes into a 200 fund. I may have to have some finance people come up here. That had generated a substantial amount of money. The legislative auditor said that money was too high, that we needed to spend it down. It's an account that we're allowed to carry over from year to year, but it was increasing too much. So our solution to spend it down was to create these additional sentence to service crews. We've spent that down now, and as you know, when you spend down that one-time money and so forth, all of a sudden we're at the point that we need to have some permanent funding to continue to manage these crews.
Now I'm really confused. Senator Neville, can you help?
No. I understood.
You understood it?
I understood
okay.
What you said, yeah.
You all right, so you were told you had too much money, and so you spent it, and now you need more money. Is that the long and short of it?
Right. Yeah. Right, Madam Chair. It was like a savings account that had built up there from the revenues as we were providing sentence to service crews. That got to be too much, where it was up in the hundreds of thousands, almost $1 million. We continue to be able to carry that over, but some of that revenue is being used, but we needed to spend it down. These six crews that we talked in the contract with Hennepin County was our solution to that. We told those people at the time, this may be just temporary. We may have to, at some point in time, cancel these crews. And that would be our solution if we're not able to fund it. But after a period of time that they've been running for about 6 years, people start to expect it. Those local sheriffs start to expect it. The community starts to expect it. I'm sure Hennepin County would like to continue their program. This is our solution to continue that.
Senator Rosen?
Oh, thank you, Madam Chair. Just to comment that this was the one thing from my small communities, the Brycelands, the Delvins, the Ceylons, where they really depended on the sentence to serve. And when we did have the budget deficits in 03 and some of the programs were cut and expansion of where they could go, they felt it really, really hard. So this is a great program out in Greater Minnesota.
Mm-hmm. Senator Neville.
Madam Chair, Mr. Nelson, does this extra money, is that just for the staff, or do you pay the inmates some money, don't you, when they're on sentence to service?
Commissioner Nelson. Chair Senator Neville, this is mainly for the crews, and then there's other costs with equipment. If they're out cutting brush, you've got chainsaws, you've got special equipment and gear that the offenders do not get paid for this.
They don't get paid for sentence to service?
They do not get paid for sentence to service.
I thought at the county level, pretty common that they, I mean, where does the money come from when a judge gives somebody 30 days in jail, or you can work it off 240 hours of community service time and we'll pay you $5? $5 an hour. Where does that money come from? I thought you did it the same way in corrections.
Maybe Senator Engelbrecht.
I think they get $5 an hour credit.
Credit.
Yeah.
To that fine. That's right. What it is. Yeah.
Right. Right. It's credit.
So they don't actually get any money. They just take it off.
Well, sometimes I thought they use it for restitution.
Madam Chair, I know in Ramsey County we had donations that funded a fund, and so juveniles who were working off would get paid $5, you know, an hour, and then it would be applied toward their restitution. But that's a real kind of a small program. I just saw Fred LaFleur over there shaking his head. They don't get paid in Hennepin for it, and I know Ramsey didn't either.
All right, thanks.
Okay. Madam Chair, Senator Neville, there are some other ICWIC crews that we send out that do house building that do get paid. So there are some of those type of crews where they are out in the community and they are paid a minimal nominal amount for their work.
Okay. Thanks.
Okay. Any other questions? Okay. Continue on, please.
Short-term offenders, and you see the first thing that's a major concern of the counties, and it has been. The counties house about, we've averaged about 300 offenders a day committed to the DOC, and these are ones that are committed for 180 days or less to serve. Those numbers are starting to climb on us again. If you remember when this program first started, we thought it would be about 200 a day, and it climbed to 300. And I think it's climbing over that 300 mark now. But the current appropriation as a result of that is down to $10 a day. The original budget amount by the legislature was $1.2 million a year. Of that, we took 20% or a little over $200,000 and reserved it for medical expenses. Those medical expenses have ran about a low of $26,000 a year to $76,000 a year. But we don't need and we don't spend for inpatient care for short-term time. We roll back into the per diem. But even with rolling that back into the per diem, they've been getting about $10 a day per offender. This additional increase of almost $2.2 million, we project would bring it up closer to $30 a day. Tripling that cost. And the counties probably, this is not necessarily enough for them. Many of them will say that our costs are at least $55 a day, but it makes a good shot at going back and compensating them closer to what their costs would be.
Just wondering if maybe Senator Berglund can help on this too, but what's the history on why did we begin to keep the short-term offenders at the county level again? Was that just a budget balancing device about 3-4 years ago?
I think it was partly a policy decision and partly a budget decision. The policy reason involved in it was really when we get them and they have such a short time to be with us, we don't really get to provide them with any rehabilitation services. And there's a lot of money in processing people when they come into your system to evaluate them for everything from, you know, chemical dependency, mental health, everything from their health status. So the feeling was that it wasn't very efficient for them to be transferred to the state. In addition to that, of course, there was some budget savings taken as a result of it.
Okay. Any other questions on that topic? If Senator Higgins is back. Well, I had it for a second. Before I give it back to you, I have a question.
Sure, go ahead.
I'd like to just go back to the sex offender statistics I've always been, I guess every year, every budget year, I ask the same question on the sex offender registry. Do we have reports that we keep on that show, you know, how do we measure cost versus benefit of keeping all that? We spend a lot of money maintaining that registry. Do you measure how much good it's really doing us somehow?
Madam Chair, Senator Neville, the registry is done by the BCA, the Bureau of Criminal Apprehension, okay. So it's in a different budget. So we're just giving you those numbers. The State Department of Corrections does the Level 3 website, and there's approximately 100 on that website that are out in the community, but our only portion of it is the public website.
There's the bottom half on here on the slide then.
There's
about 7,000 sex offenders on supervision. Those are yours. There's 14,000 active registrants. So we got about 7,000 that are now off of supervision that we still track. So that's public safety, I got to ask.
That's local law enforcement. They're required to report in when they move or where they live, where their second home is, their automobile, and so forth, to local law enforcement, who then in turn provides that information to the BCA, and the BCA keeps track of that. I think it is probably a fairly successful in the fact that if there is a crime that's committed in that area, local law enforcement or all of law enforcement immediately has records of where the sex offenders are living and which ones are near.
Right.
And so
I'm aware of that. I just wonder, I mean, I hear every once in a while about a high-profile case where, you know, we solve the case because we know who to ask or where to look. I just wonder how many of those there are. And let me just ask about the ones that are under your jurisdiction, the 6945. Do we track them long enough so that we get meaningful recidivism data out of that? Does corrections do that?
Commissioner Nelson.
Madam Chair, Senator Neville, yes, we have done recidivism reports in the past on level 1, 2, and 3 sex offenders. I believe we have something coming out in the near future on some recidivism data.
All right. Well, I'll wait till the report comes out then.
Senator Foley.
Thank you, Madam Chair. One of the concerns has been the counties are concerned about the fact that the state is not paying the entire cost there, but part of that might be for services or something. What's the difference between somebody incarcerated in your institutions versus the ones that are on the short-term offenders? And are they short-term offenders, I guess, getting any kind of treatment or preparation for discharge and so forth?
Commissioner Nelson.
Madam Chair, Senator Foley, it depends upon their length. Some of them are coming in, and we actually owe them time, and they're just going to be checking them into the jail and then putting them back out on conditional release. The others that are coming in for 1 or 2 months at the most probably are not going to get into any long-term programming in the jail. There may be some things that they can do with GED, starting on some preparation for taking GED tests. But if the ones that are coming in there for up to 4, 5, 6 months, I think the local jails are better and quicker to respond to their needs and to get them into some of that local jail programming, because that's their expectations. Most of their clients do roll through faster. The jails, some of the jails will tell you their costs are like $70 a day. I think they've kind of settled in on the $55 a day because it's such a variety throughout the state of Minnesota. It's also a variety of what kind of treatment programs are offered. In a workhouse in Ramsey County or Hennepin County, they, of course, are geared up for many more type of resources and programs than they are for a small local jail that has the jailers and little else. So it's kind of a wide variety throughout the state.
Senator Foley?
Follow up on that. I noticed there was some controversy with Ramsey County and the incarceration of immigrants. And it seemed to me that there wasn't any... there were people that were incarcerated for as long as a year that weren't getting any kind of treatment or counseling or anything. Is that true or not?
Commissioner Nelson?
And Chair, Senator Foley, the adult facility in Ramsey, just quickly, they were holding them in the place where they hold them for pretrial, and if they held them there for a long time, they probably were not getting the kind of programming they would at the Ramsey County Workhouse. Throughout the state, though, there is quite a bit of, just let me read off what kind of programming is available in the jails. AANA, Narcotics Anonymous, Alcoholics Anonymous, GED education, a lot of them. Most of them here on this list are providing that. Work release, of course, some job search. Religious programs are quite active in all of the jails throughout the state. The very few jails, some do offer parenting. Anger management, coping skills, or COG groups. Again, it's probably about a fourth of the jails that offer that. Some health education and some cultural-specific programs and some of them. So it clearly is, there's not the wide breadth of programming that we can do in our prisons when people are coming for 2, 3, 4 years. But there is some pretty good programming. But, again, it varies across the state. The Ramsey County thing, by the very nature definition of a jail, you're supposed to be there for a year or less. There may be some cases. There were some times, but it's a rare case where the judge can send them to the local jail, and they can do it and make the sentence concurrent or, excuse me, consecutive. So on a rare occasion, you may get somebody in a local jail for more than a year, but that would be a rarity.
Okay, Senator Berglund.
I didn't, Madam Chair and Assistant Commissioner Nelson, I didn't hear when you said chemical dependency treatment. Is that in every jail across the state?
Madam Chair, Senator Berlin, the list I have here almost has every jail checked off for that, so that's very common. 76 different chemical dependency programs within our jails in the state of Minnesota.
And how many of those would be an AA group? As compared to active treatment?
I would guess most of it is AA groups as opposed to chemical dependency treatment. You're talking about AA groups mm-hmm. or Narcotics mm-hmm. Anonymous groups. You have people coming in and running those groups. It's not hardcore type of chemical dependency treatment.
And Madam Chair, and then many of the jails charge the prisoner for being a participant in an AA group. So, you know, we passed a law that said they could charge prisoners for services that are provided.
What kind of reentry services are they getting in the jails? Are they getting any reentry help?
Madam Chair, I would guess that again varies depending upon the nature of it. The workhouses probably have more staff. They have more casework staff to assist with some of that. And I would guess that some of the very small jails probably do very little and don't have the staffing pattern to do that. So, again, it's probably a wide variety across the state of Minnesota as far as reentry services. They are in the community, however, and some of them are pretty good at trying to get community resources in to work with the prisoners. And at a certain point, if they are eligible for work release and have a little more freedom, I know at times they will let them out to go to certain programs. Very controlled, but I know that that does happen in some of the jails across the state.
Commissioner Benson.
Madam Chair, I'd like to respond to the short-termers, though, with respect to reentry and what the arrangement that we made when we made this policy change 4 years ago or 3.5 years ago is that the state would continue to, we would check them into our system. In other words, they continued to be committed to the commissioner. And we would also then, the state would do the reentry planning. So we are doing that from the St. Cloud Reformatory. And we're suggesting that that is not a good practice. In fact, we're beginning to talk with the locals about a different arrangement with respect to the reentry process for these short-term offenders. They really are analogous to a probationer who's serving a 4 or 5 month stay in a local facility, but the state is doing the release planning from St. Cloud. So the release planning is occurring long distance, without face-to-face contact, without the knowledge of what's available locally to these offenders before they go out. So I think that's a piece that needs to be fixed here. And the reality is, I absolutely agree with Senator Berglund that this was certainly a budgetary-driven issue that brought to a head what I think, I'll speak for myself, was a poor policy practice, and that these very short-termers with what essentially was a local sanction were penetrating our system to the degree of St. Cloud, Stillwater, one of our medium custody facilities, only to get through the check-in process, doing all of the expensive assessments. There was virtually no time for programming for somebody with just 6 months or less to serve. And most of these people had 4 months or less to serve. So we were warehousing them, turning them around, and sending them back to that very same community that they came from. So I think we've got some work to do, but the good news is we are talking with our local partners, and I think we've got some ideas about how we might make this even more efficient. But certainly I never agreed that people with a local sentence should be coming to the state correctional system. And I think we kind of landed in the middle when the commissioner came on board 4 years ago. She thought 6 months was a good line in the sand, and I certainly agree with that, that over 6 months we can start to work with them at the state level, but any less time than that, and it's going to be that same degree of dead time that they might experience in some county jails.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And mainly just a comment. The top bullet point is major concern for counties. And I know out in greater Minnesota, several of my counties are looking at building new jails. It's cheaper right now, though, to ship them off to another county. But this funding difference might change their minds. There isn't a week that goes by where there isn't some controversy about the new jail and the cost. And it's cheaper to ship to Fremont County where they just built a new jail. But increasing it by the $30 a day might make a difference for them. And then they can provide the treatment right there and keep it going. So just a comment.
Any other questions or comments? Continue on, please.
Mm-hmm. Madam Chair, offender reentry, and this is something that I think is important to all of us, and it's the right way to go, I can't say we're starting it again, because I think we've always done it and that we continue to do it, but we need to do it better. 95% of all inmates are eventually going to be released from prison. There's over 6,000 coming out each year. More and more, they're having problems with housing, employment, community support, and so forth, the mental health issues and so forth. And we need to make sure in those critical, especially the critical first hours and first days that they come out, that we don't lose them. And so this is a modest proposal, $1.5 million each year. We're looking at some pilot projects to happen in Hennepin, Ramsey, and Olmsted County. We're looking to add some transitional coordinators. We're not ignoring juveniles. We're going to look at Red Wing and improving our reentry initiatives there for the juveniles also. We'll continue to work with all the counties while we're putting some special emphasis on Ramsey, Hennepin, and Olmsted. We'll also continue to be looking at reentry issues throughout the whole state of Minnesota. We're not going to ignore the other counties. Now, we're doing this with a partnership. This has been going on. We've been working together in this partnership with the different state agencies. We're also pulling in the counties now, especially in those pilot areas. We'll be looking to put about $1 million of this out into RFPs, into the community, to assist us with this project. We're looking for other foundations. We're going after other grants. We're waiting for the federal government Second Chance Act, and we want to be in a position to go after some Second Chance Act money in addition. And so this is a very important project. I don't know if the commissioner wants to say more, or Deputy Commissioner Benson wants to talk more about this, but this is going to be a real focal point in the next years, and not just the next 2 years. But we're talking about the next 4, 5, 10 years. I think this is an answer to reduce the recidivism, certainly for public safety, to reduce technical violations and turn them around. And we do know that it does work. We can be successful at it.
Commissioner Nelson, you've had folks internally working on reentry issues for quite some time, though, haven't you?
We certainly have, and we have for the last couple of years. So we do have some core staff at central office working on this. We have some reentry people. These are going to be putting more people in the institutions, though, as far as transitional coordinators. We feel we need to take them from the institution to the community and make sure they don't get lost. So this is just beefing up that effort.
Okay. So are you adding to staff with this proposal?
There will be some staff added at Red Wing and at the adult facilities.
I didn't hear that.
There will be staff added both at Red Wing and at some of the adult facilities to assist with this program.
All right. Senator Berglund.
Madam Chair and Assistant Commissioner Nelson, how much of the $1.5 million each year is going to be used within the correctional facilities for discharge planning as compared with how much of it will be used for services in the community to provide that offender with reentry assistance once they're discharged?
It's going to approximately be about $1.2 million. It'll be going out into the community, 1.2, and then 300,000 that'll be staying within the institutions.
Senator Rosen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Commissioner, what specific population will this be more geared towards? What kind of population that offended?
These will all be people leaving the prison on the higher risk, but we'll be looking at all people leaving the prison coming out, but we certainly want to concentrate on the higher risk. But we have the core numbers in the cities of Minneapolis, St. Paul, and Rochester, so that the numbers are larger, so that we have the economies of scales to do that kind of programming for those numbers in that area. But we certainly, anybody that's coming out of prison, by definition, to some degree, is fairly high risk already, because they made it to prison. But we'll be looking at the ones that are in need of help of housing, that are in need of help of mental health issues, that are in need of help of chemical dependency issues, that are in need of assistance in job finding, job search, all of those different programs. Is the kind of wraparound type of service we want to provide. We want to do it in coordination with the probation agents. I think that you need to work. They're critical and they're key in that.
Senator Berger?
Madam Chair, Assistant Commissioner Nelson, so with this $1.5 million per year increase, how many offenders will be served?
Commissioner Nelson.
Madam Chair, Senator Berlin, I don't know that that's completely been determined now. We're going to have to put out some RFPs to see what response we get from the community and what kind of service they can provide. We hope to use this as leverage, like I said before, with foundations and other agencies. We hope to use it as leverage with the counties in their own Hennepin, Ramsey, and so forth, as far as coordinating and working with them where their needs are. And we'll that's yet to be determined, though. I can't give you a number right now.
Madam Chair and Assistant Commissioner Nelson, when would you be able to give me a number?
Commissioner Nelson.
Yep. Madam Chair, Senator Berglund, I would guess within the next couple of months as they work some, we'll have more better information to you on the numbers.
Well, Madam Chair, I would hope it would be before the budget's finished in this division.
I sure hope so, too. Senator Neville?
Mr. Chair, Mr. Nelson, is this money strictly for staff to assist, or is this also money for rent or money for treatment or mental health or CD treatment, or is it just for the staff to facilitate?
Madam Chair, Senator Berglund, as we put out the RFPs and ask for what kind of programming that we need, we will come up with what the needs are of these offenders, and it could be used in a variety of ways. Some of it could be community services who are staff and are providing that service for them. It could be a mixture. We also have other funds. We have the other housing money that we have that's there from previous years that the legislature authorized. That's still there and available to help with some of this. This isn't the total amount. There's some other funds out there to help with this initiative.
Commissioner, when you come back again to talk about this, will you give us the rest of that information as well? The housing money that you said was available, the other wraparound services that are available, because we don't seem to have a total picture here.
Certainly.
Okay. Senator Foley.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. Mr. Nelson, when you discussed something earlier, you talked about mental health and those issues. Tell me what happens when you discharge someone that is mentally ill or is treated for that. Is there a drug program that carries them through for a given period of time and so forth?
Madam Chair, Senator Foley, I'm going to refer here to Nan.
Welcome back.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Foley, we have a number of discharge planners whose focus is entirely on our severe and persistently mentally ill offenders. They work with those offenders pretty much from the time they enter. They're all licensed independent clinical practitioners, so they have an ability to diagnose as well. They spend a good release plan, takes about 20 hours, and it encompasses everything from housing, employment, as well as contacts with community mental health providers. They ensure that they have appointments set up with their community community psychiatrist so that they can ensure that they have someone who can prescribe medications. We also send the release plan to a community mental health provider who is not a psychiatrist, so somebody who can follow them in the community. The agent will also get a copy of the release plan so that they know where their appointments are, when the appointments are scheduled, where the housing is supposed to be, what kind of employment. We'll get them signed up for Social Security disability income. We'll get them signed up for one of the state's health care programs. We will provide them with medications as they're walking out the door. The amount depends entirely on the therapeutically safe level. So if they should only have a 7-day supply, we'll only give them a 7-day supply. But we will give them a prescription for that medication as well as their medication administration records, so their community providers know exactly what they've been taking and for how long.
When you're doing that, Madam Chair, when you I've had people come to me and tell me that this is not the same, that the state provides these exit surveys, if you will, or assistance, but that the short-term offenders or people in county jails and workhouses aren't getting any of that. Is that, do you know whether that's true or not?
Madam Chair and Senator Foley, our release planners only work for those people incarcerated in our prisons. It's much more difficult, I think, for a county jail to provide those kinds of services given the short-term nature of those inmates' stay. Are they providing those kinds of services? I can't answer that question, but I know it would be much more difficult.
Senator Foley?
No, I defer.
Okay. Senator Berglund.
Madam Chair and Ms. Larson, how many of the people that you do discharge planning for with serious and persistent mental illness are able to get an appointment with a psychiatrist within the 2-month period following their discharge so that they can get renewed prescriptions?
Madam Chair and Senator Berglund, I don't have that number exactly. I can tell you, though, that we have some pretty tenacious release planners, and they are very good about getting appointments for our offenders coming out who have those problems. But I can certainly try and get that information. I don't know if I'm going to be able to, but I certainly can try.
Well, I just wondered, because if they're not able to get the appointment, then, you know, that's a problem in the continuity of the discharge planning. So,
do the release planners set up those appointments before the person is released?
Madam Chair, yes, that's correct. Mm-hmm. Which is why I feel that they're pretty successful, because and that information goes right to the agent, so that the agent also knows that the offender has an appointment with that community provider.
Okay. Senator Rosen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And along that note, Ms. Larson, I think something else to keep in mind, along with your support, is the transportation piece of this all. It's great to have an appointment, but if you can't get there, yeah, it's great to mm-hmm. have a drug court in your county, but if you can't get there. So I think we're missing a lot on being able to accommodate people's needs here in transportation. I'm in a lecture.
Other questions? Senator Foley?
Thank you, Madam Chair. When you're dealing with those folks that are being discharged, what one of the problems that Senator Berglund pointed out was the fact that they got a small amount, you're talking about 7 days, and then they get a prescription. The mental health agency that I'm working with as a director has a situation where we don't get anyone that has had or in that position for less than 60 days. That's the current wait. So how do they get any drugs to fill the gap during that period?
Madam Chair and Senator Foley, we do give all of the offenders a prescription, a paper prescription, for their medications as they're walking out the door. So not only do we give them a supply, but we'll give them a prescription as well.
But the prescription,
Senator Foley,
Madam Chair, you're talking about 7 days. Do they come back in then after the 7 days to fill the gap?
Madam Chair and Senator Foley, the prescription may not be for 7 days. We would give them an actual supply of potentially 7 days. If it's therapeutically safe to give them something more than that, we will certainly do it, up to 30-day supply.
All right. Continue on, please.
Madam Chair and members, before we leave reentry, I just wanted to say a couple things about what occurs inside of our correctional facilities. We do have transition coordinators now in just about all of our correctional facilities. And in addition to providing pre-release planning, they're coordinating job fairs. It's mandatory that everybody being released from prison goes through pre-release planning. But again, as Deputy Commissioner Nelson said, I think what we, in the institution side of things, we want to take this a little bit further as well. And we really want to start the reentry process almost the day that these offenders are coming into the facility. Given that the average sentence is about 33, 34 months, that's how long most of our offenders are staying with us. It makes sense that we start that process very early on in terms of trying to understand what their needs are and developing an institution plan along the lines of chemical dependency treatment, sex offender treatment, finishing a GED, getting a vocational trade, those kinds of things, and then setting them up for some kind of a continuum of care once they enter the community. And I think the model out there that has worked well is the CIP model, where we do release them treated. They get very good supervision. They do go to a house or a halfway house or a jail. They're seen four times a week by an agent. They have a job or they're going into treatment. And we've experienced a lot of success with those people. And the same with the serious and persistent mentally ill. We do a good job, I think, of handing the baton from the institution to the community in those few cases. There's not a lot of them every year. But I think that's kind of textbook in terms of how the institution ought to be communicating with the community agent or a community service provider once they are released. And I think that's been missing for many, many years in our system for all of those people in the middle in terms of what their needs are. And there are some things that I think are part of that recipe that they just have to have. And number one is releasing them treated if they've got the time to go through treatment. Again, understanding that 80-90% of our population abuses chemicals or is chemically dependent. Making sure they've got a place to go to, good supervision, and a job, and that continuum of care for either treatment or the mental health issues that so many of them have. So it really is a partnership with the community services providers, the Community Corrections Act counties, our county supervisors out there. We just have to bridge that gap that has been creating difficulty not only for the offender but for the system for a long time. And suffice it to say, this is not going to be cheap. And I think there are a lot of willing partners out there. We've talked with lots of different community providers. What we're looking for are the more pieces to the puzzle that are available, I think the better, so we can do one-stop shopping in terms of a provider that provides employment possibilities, housing, treatment, or getting them hooked up to treatment, insurance, or getting them signed up. Psychiatric or psychological follow-up if that's indicated. So this is, from my perspective, been around for a long time. I think it's an exciting initiative, one that we're happy to see the interest and hopefully the support as we move through the legislative process here.
Commissioner Benson, what happens in Appleton? Are all the same services provided in Appleton, the private prison?
Madam Chair and members, to some degree there are. Many of those people come back to our system prior to being released. In fact, most of them come back to us. Many of them come back to participate in treatment. But at this point, they're not geared to release a lot of people directly to the community, so most of them would cycle back through one of our institutions and participate in the pre-release planning. They do have a treatment program out there. They do have educational components now. They have some vocational components. They have a work program out there. So we are in touch with what is available. And if they're, again, if their case plan would indicate other needs that they can't get out there, number one, we may not send them out there to begin with, or number two, we might bring them back at some point during their incarceration and meet their needs in the state end of the system.
Okay. Senator Berglund?
Madam Chair and Assistant Commissioner Benson, under the state TANF program, there is an option for states to not allow people who have been incarcerated with a drug felony to be allowed back into the TANF program. Minnesota has taken that option, and I'm wondering how that fits in with what you're talking about in terms of reentry services and whether or not there would be any benefit to the state to re-examine that particular option.
Madam Chair, Senator Berglund, perhaps we could have more conversation around that issue. Ms. Larson tells me that probably is a DHS issue.
Well, it's also an issue for you because if a person coming out who otherwise would be eligible for MFIP services can't get them, A, they don't have any means of support for their children if they're going to be reunified with their children, and B, they are not eligible for those employment services that otherwise might be available through the TANF program. And C, oftentimes if they're not eligible for the TANF program, they may not then also be enrolled in a health care program.
Madam Chair, Senator Berglund, I think this is exactly why we have the MCOR group together, because we do have, you know, deputies from the 10 state agencies. So I think this is a perfect thing to bring up, you know, with in our next meeting to see if there is something we can do.
Madam Chair.
Mr. Berglund.
Commissioner, it has never been discussed up till now.
Mr. Fabian.
Madam Chair, Senator Berglund, I'm not sure. I haven't been involved in all of the meetings, and it certainly could have been. And, you know, we don't know right now.
Well, it would seem like there would be quite a few and a growing number of people in that situation in your correctional facilities these days.
Right.
That's right.
Madam Chair, Senator Berglund, if it hasn't been discussed, it will be.
Okay. Continue on, please.
Madam Chair and members, this next slide is the issue that we did discuss earlier. It is the compensation adjustment, or the COLA adjustment that it is more commonly referred to. This is the 4.25 for the direct care employees and the 2% for the employees that don't provide direct care. First year, it's 10.16 4 million, and in 09 it's 20.736, total of 30.9 million. And again, we've had this discussion several consecutive years now with respect to the impact that inflation has on our budget in the event that we don't get it. And it's a huge number. It's over 600 positions worth of funding just to continue to keep up with the inflationary rate that our employees are provided through negotiated contracts. 82% of the funding is for staffing at our 10 correctional facilities, and 11% for those those agents that provide service in our communities. And it covers the employer-paid insurance increases, across the board increases and step increases that are negotiated each contract, biennial contract. And then the last area that we just want to touch on, bring to your attention, if this will go to bonding committee, but I imagine we'll hear it here too. We do have two emergency bonding requests as part of the governor's budget. The first is emergency asset preservation for the perimeter system at our high security, our maximum security institution at Oak Park Heights. I mentioned this the other day at the tour that we had some major issues at Oak Park Heights, one being a perimeter system that was beginning to fail quite rapidly. Again, we have a population out there that is challenging. We have number of people out there that are never going to get out of prison. They really are the worst of the worst in terms of those people that we have an obligation to protect the public from. And the fundamental line of defense is our perimeter security system. We have a very outdated shaker system on the fence, one that we can no longer get parts for, and that causes a great deal of concern on our part. We also have an inferior lighting system out there and camera system at that facility. We actually have better perimeter systems at our medium custody institutions than our maximum custody institution. These really are asset preservation items. We had hoped last year when we got our bonding appropriation that we might be able to do some work on this, but as you know, we were appropriated lots of money for beds, but our asset preservation was cut in half, and we had other competing priorities for those dollars. We just feel, given the population out there and the shape that that perimeter is in, that this is something that we have to aggressively move forward with to try to upgrade. The second part of that...
just a second, Commissioner Benson.
Oh, Senator Wilson. Sorry. Thank you, Madam Chair. Commissioner Benson, do you have to follow any federal guidelines as far as perimeters and safety and security? Are there any federal guidelines that you have to live with?
Madam Chair and Senator Rosen, no, there aren't. Perimeter security is kind of all over the map. What we have prescribed to, though, or subscribed to over the years, is a model that we've been working with the federal government and Sandia Labs. Sandia Labs does most of the perimeter installations for all of the military plants and bases around the country, and also nuclear installations. And we've worked with them in terms of how you design a perimeter system that does several things for you. It detects, delays, and respond, gives you time to respond. And that is the model that we've built around our medium custody institutions. In fact, coincidentally, last week we just trained about 30 younger middle managers in terms of how to develop this perimeter system protocol. So it's served us well. We were always hesitant to brag about the fact that we haven't had an escape in a number of years, as they could be tunneling under a fence as we're talking about it. But the reality is we haven't, and we just want to keep that record alive, especially in the context of our maximum security institution. So this is an important one for the agency. Again, the technology is so advanced today from what it was even 25 years ago when we built this place that it's that's a good thing. The other emergency request included in the governor's budget is a $2.242 million request to finally deal with this Oak Park Heights ventilation system. Unfortunately, this system has not worked well since this prison was opened back in 1982. As I explained to the tour group, the protocol back in that day was to put the insulation on the inside of these massive 6 and 8 foot ducts as they came out of the power plant, or in our case, it was the chiller area where we would put chilled air through this ventilation system that had the fiberglass on the inside, and it really creates the ideal environment with that cool air to actually grow mold. So we've had a mold problem in that institution for a long time. We have tried various cures for this, into and including removing some of the insulation. We tried encapsulating it with a tar-like substance, but there's always enough of it left to continue to promote the growth of mold, and we've had some workers' comp issues around this. We've had some medical issues around this problem, and we already have invested $1.45 million. That was what we used some of the asset preservation money for last year, and we just really need to get this thing finally taken care of. We also had a roof problem out there, a leaky roof, another flat roof that we have entirely replaced now, and we also use some of that emergency asset money to finally complete the last phase of that. So this is kind of the final piece of hopefully a 25-year-old problem.
Okay, any questions? I'm amazed you actually went through that whole thing in one meeting. If there are no other questions from the committee, are there people in the audience who want to comment about the corrections budget in some way? We've had a lot of people sitting here through the whole presentation. Okay. If not, we are adjourned. Thank you all very much.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you.
Thank you.